Today we're talking one-time directors on this episode. Janine also has some fun social media debates that have been raging lately to get into more games, more silliness, more great discussion on another episode of Monday Madness. Welcome back to the madness. Hello everyone, welcome back to Monday Madness with Morgan and the Machine. How many times can I say the word madness in the space of a minute, Janine?
I don't know, I guess we'll see. Keep going. Well,
I've just done a pretty good job, I don't want to do any more.
Okay.
It will be inappropriate to do any more, but it's good to be back. Season 2, Episode 2 of Monday Madness. We started pretty well last week. I enjoyed our discussion last week. It was a deep one. It was a contentious topic of a discussion. Today, I think, is going to be far more just personal opinion and not cause potential chaos in some sort of comment section or, you know, perhaps discourse outside of just us two. That's what we're dealing with today. I think it's singular opinions on who are the best one-time directors. It will be an interesting let's talk to get into. But before we do any of that, I know we're excited to be back for a second episode of season two, Janine, but I'll say it properly this time. So, Janine.
There are a few things up with me. I mentioned last week how I've been doing these Spider-Man Mondays and the last time I saw Spider-Man 2. So of course now I've seen Spider-Man 3 on the big screen. And I gotta say, this was a fun communal experience. While this film really delves into some more comedic and silly aspects and really doesn't focus on more meaningful themes like the first two did, you know, due to this not wholly being the movie Sam Raimi wanted to make, studio interference, forcing more villains in, all of that kind of thing. The silliness of this film made for a really fun group viewing experience. So when all of the certain cues came up, the memeable cues came up. It was a very fun group laughter that came about. As soon as the bangs came into the face and we heard the quote unquote Bully Maguire little theme trill, the whole crowd was like, oh. In the scene where the get on up dancing, like everyone was clapping along. In the scene where Peter ends up slapping MJ, somebody just yelled out, "Not cool." So, it was a lot of fun getting into the kind of silliness of what 3 ended up being. So definitely kind of a disappointment on its initial first release. But I think over the years, it's kind of grown in just this fun, it is what it is kind of situation with characters that we've grown to love over two other films. Knowledge of knowing that it's not what Raimi wanted, I think people can kind of cut it some slack there. So it was fun.
Yeah, I think my thing with something like Spider-Man 3 is that it's always... Didn't we always know that it wasn't the movie Raimi fully wanted it to be?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I've always been the kind of mentality movie watcher of take it for what it is. And you do take it for what it is. If you want to laugh at it, laugh at it. That's still enjoying it. It might not be enjoying it as you expected to enjoy it, but it's still enjoying it. So having that communal kind of enjoyment watching of it, recognizing its stupid parts, but actually genuinely enjoying its good parts. What's wrong with doing that? It shouldn't be. I don't think we should kind of bash and slam on these kind of movies that you know, they're not the world's worst movies. The people who are calling those sort of movies the world's worst movies, you're fairly lackluster superhero movies, I mean. I haven't seen what actual bad movies
look like, yeah.
Because actual bad movies are incoherent and just don't even look like a movie. They look like they're filmed on some sort of phone from the mid-2000s, and it's all over the place. Technically, you can have bad films, but in story and execution, it's just
there's perhaps a ton of factors. Yeah,
there's a ton of factors, and it just ends up ultimately being not what the viewer expected. That's my feeling.
Yes. So it was nice having this, seen this film and have it kind of have this fun redemption in the theater. And then I also got to see The Mummy, on the big screen for its 25th
anniversary. Yeah, it will be 25th. Yeah. Brendan Fraser.
Yes. So I'd never seen that movie on the big screen. So it was really great because I always forget to really count it among my favorite films because I think it's generally a great film. Again, I mean, you just talked about technical failures of a film, obviously in, you know, 99, 2000 special effects aren't what they are today. So that's kind of the biggest downfall of the film. But story-wise, action-wise, performance-wise, I mean, probably the most, if not one of the most gorgeous casts of all time. Like everyone in that movie is incredibly attractive. You know, we don't get The Mummy for a while, you realize, but they fill every scene before we get to kind of our title character with some great action and some great character development. You really feel the setting, you know, the time period with the costuming and the settings that they're in and the score. Everything looks beautiful. Brendan Fraser, like, I'm so sad that these films kind of just wrecked his body because he was so good, not just at physical comedy in a lot of his other roles, but in action, because, you know, he feels very much like this old-timey action adventure star. I mean, he's doing things like, you know, striking a match on Odette Fair's stubble to light it and like taking the fuse off a stick of dynamite and like, you know, just really just a cool and Rachel Weisz absolutely gorgeous in this film. The comedy is great as well. So just seeing it on the big screen was so much fun. I remember I was friends with this really rich girl who, you know, she was like a year above me. I think this movie came out when I was like a sophomore in high school and she was a junior. So she had a car and money. So she could go to the movies like that. I couldn't. And after she saw this movie, she came up to me and was telling me, oh my gosh, I found my new all-time favorite movie. It was so good. And she's telling me all about it. So I'm like excited to see this movie. And I don't think I would see it until like the next year when it was out on, you know, DVD or whatever. And we watch it like on the school bus for a school bus trip. So the first time I saw this movie was on a tiny little screen on a school bus. So going from that first time viewing to now getting to see it on the big screen was just really cool experience and such a good movie. And they don't shy away, you know, from the horror origins of the character and of the story. It's like a very much like the Invisible Man remake. This very much is like a really cool, modern, adventure filled way to readapt this kind of iconic universal monster and still, you know, have the horror elements, but also throw in some romance and some action, some really fun things. So Mummy is such a good movie. It's such a good movie.
It is. It's pure action adventure, pure action adventure that you don't get even now, 25 years later, because you certainly don't get it feeling like this. And you mentioned the effects that it's not the effects that are ever an issue for me. I think there's almost too much that is actually tangible about The Mummy that you don't get in action adventure movies now that actually makes it feel like they are in a sandy location full of sand and in these caves and everything like that. You don't quite get that in. You didn't even get that in, say, Indiana Jones 5, did you?
Yeah.
You didn't get that same tangibility, I don't think. Yeah, okay, some, but not even as much as something like The Mummy. I mean, I haven't watched much of anything at all this week that wasn't actually for the shows that we have. Okay, so I'm not going to do that. And in terms of movies and TV, I mean, but I have been watching, because of when we're recording this, I've been watching the World Snooker Championships. Yeah. Nobody else cares about. Well, that's what I've been watching in my free time this week. Okay. It's been a funny tournament.
Oh, nice. Okay. What do you mean by funny?
I mean, unexpected upsets, okay, and a weird, it's actually the final now as we're speaking, because the finals played over 2 days. Mm-hmm. This was, again, at the time of this recording, this is long past. We know who's won at this point. It's long past. But it's two very unexpected people in the final. So it's kind of interesting. But nobody much cares about snooker that isn't me. People might not even know what snooker is. It's just a billiard cue sport. Think of pool, but way more technical and bigger and more tactical.
Yeah, despite it sounding like the name of some type of British biscuit or cookie, it is, in fact, a sport. Get you a pack of Snookers to dip into your tea.
You're thinking of Snickers. Snickers is a perfectly reasonable chocolate bar. You're thinking of Snickers.
No, I am not. I am not.
Okay. I think you are, but there
No.
Before we get into our main discussion on our one-time directors, what are these little social media
things that you wanted to bring So, up? Firstly, there's been this, it's not really a debate, but it's like the hateful rhetoric around this has gotten a lot of likes when it's a very straightforward complaint and frustration amongst Black people and Black women in particular, because this makeup brand called Youthphoria got some criticism for having a very limited shade range in their foundations, which is a common problem that Black skinned women, makeup artists, particularly like very dark skin tones, you know, have issues with. So in getting complaints about this limited shade range for darker skin tones, they put out a new shade called, shade 600. So when darker skinned Black makeup artists tried out this pigment, it turned out that it was pure Black. There were no undertones.
Oh dear.
So every skin type, every skin tone has at least some undertones. Typically, Black people have maybe some red, some orange, yellow undertones. If you're really a deep, dark Black, there's blue or green undertones in your skin tone. So
this is just pure jet black.
Yeah. So any foundation will have other pigments mixed in to get the right shade with undertones in it. This shade, if you look up the ingredients list, this only has like this iron oxide pigment, nothing else. It's pure Black. And the girl who tested it, she says, one of these on the side of my face is Youthphoria's 600 foundation. This other side of my face is Black face paint. Tell the difference. And you can't tell the difference. So So it was literally felt very pandering, like, okay, Black people, you complain here, we're giving you a shade. And so, and so that's what it felt like. And so Black creators and Black makeup artists were rightfully calling them out. A lot of just general, like white, all kinds of makeup artists were calling them out because this is a Black face paint. There's literally no other pigments. Even Black jet Black mascara or eyeshadow have layers of different colors of pigments in them to get your Black.
That's not a good look. I can't imagine why. Did you say it's received somewhat positive?
Okay, no. So generally, people think this is a bad, terrible, hateful, racist kind of thing that this company has done. But you'll look at the videos on some of these girls who are calling this out, and you'll have a comment in there that says, what are you people complaining about? You wanted your shade for Black people. Well, you got it. You're never happy with anything. And those comments will have thousands of likes.
But are they all like bot likes? Are they bot likes? Are they AI likes? Are they ghost likes? Come on.
But it's just very disheartening and sad when a comment like that is getting so many likes. So just a weird thing that has been a very popular on TikTok and in social media, Youthphoria. Their brand is getting a lot of shit right now, rightfully so. So that's one of the main things I've been following, considering it's something that has been very kind of discriminatory to Black people.
It cannot be difficult to have varying shades of color for Black people if you have varying shades of color for white people. We know that white people have various shades of complexion themselves.
Yes.
As do Black people. There's a whole pigmentation spectrum throughout the world.
Yes.
So if we're fine over here and over here, but we're not fine when we go over here, then we're just giving people pure, like, Black wall paint to put on your face.
It's crazy. It's
ridiculous. It's almost comical. It's almost something you would expect in some sort of absurd comedy.
Yes, it's literally blackface in a bottle. So, yeah, Youthphoria, shame on you for sure.
That's not good.
So the other big debate that's been going around, Morgan, what would you say if I posed to you the question for your mother, your close female friends, a woman in your life, a woman you care about, any woman, would you rather see them? Yes, it could be me. Would you rather see me in the woods alone with a bear or a strange man that I don't know?
There's a lot of depending factors on this, I think. Is the bear hibernating? Is the bear hungry?
We don't know anything. We don't know anything about the bear. We don't know anything about the man. But what...
I love the hypothetical of this.
What would you rather see me alone in the woods with? A bear or a man?
Either way, it's probably not going to end well. I'm just going to say that. Either way, it's not... It's unfortunately the bear... If the bear's hungry... Okay, I think you can fend... The point is, the fact there's an argument to be had is bad in itself. And the fact I'm having to say it won't be a good scenario no matter what is the whole point of this, I think.
Yes. Because
the fact that we cannot differentiate a human being man from a wild animal is insane.
Well, when this question was posed to social media... A majority of women said the bear. Mostly because...
Are these people thinking about the fact that they will get mauled to death if a hungry bear...
Yes, because the point of the thought process is you can more easily surmise what you're getting with the bear. A bear operates off instinct.
That is true.
So you know what you're getting with a bear. You know a bear is either going to leave you alone or it's going to kill you and eat you. With a man, you don't know if this man is there to save you. You don't know if this man is there to tie you up and take you to a second location. You don't know if this man is there to assault you and do terrible, horrendous things to you. You know the bear is not going to assault you. You know,
but obviously you also don't know if the man is just... perfectly pleasant.
Yes, you have no idea. So you could look at a bear and say, this bear is either going to ignore me or kill me. This man could do a number of horrendous things to me, and he's not operating really off instinct. He's operating off whatever whim, you know, strike his fancy.
That's a fair point.
So that is the argument. But what happens is the not all men crowd gets very much in their feelings. I wouldn't do that. So how dare you, blah, de, blah, de, blah. So then it forces whoever's asking the question to the person who doesn't get it. They have to kind of rephrase it. Okay, well, if you're a father to a daughter, would you want your daughter in the woods with a bear or a strange man? If you're a man in the woods, would you want to be in the woods alone with a bear or a woman? See how that question does not quite work both ways? Because would a man be threatened to be alone in the woods with a woman?
It's a no. It's a very good point to make, and an important point to make. And look, the not all men crowd are well meaning, but they need to realize that it's not about you, the individual.
Yes,
it's about 100%. The idea and fight back against the idea, not the person saying the fear, not the person giving their opinion on it. Go to the origin and fight against that. You're fighting the wrong fight to the not all men crowd.
Exactly, because we can't just look at a man and know what his intentions are. It's terrifying.
No, you can look at a bear.
Literally, I just scrolling through TikTok, I saw a story about a man who put antifreeze in his baby's milk to kill the baby because he didn't want to have to pay child support because he had this baby with a mistress. Another man who put his young son, a 5-6-year-old boy, on a treadmill at the highest incline on the highest speed, having him run because he said he was fat. The kid kept falling off, hitting his head. The father forced him back on several times. By the time it was done, the boy's heart gave out and he succumbed to his injuries.
Oh my God.
Yes, and died. Another man was caught in the subway with a shopping bag with a little hole cut and his phone facing outward with the camera so that he could videotape people at the subway. Another man is in the grocery store in like a Target or something. He sees a woman wearing a skirt. He pretends to drop a something or go to look at a book on a bottom shelf. You see him pull his phone out and put it under her skirt to film under her skirt when a lady catches him. So, I mean,
yeah, look, you can't make sense of it, but I like that it's been brought up as a hypothetical because it can be a punch in the face. And I'm not offended by this. Look, I know in my own body I'm not going to be there in the woods attacking someone.
Yes.
You know? But that's not for me to then get all up in my feelings about, oh, well I wouldn't do it.
So you
can't come around saying this. You very much can come out and say this sort of stuff because you know what happens. Be secure in your own belief. The fact I think you're not secure enough in your own stance that you have to defend yourself says a lot as well.
Yes.
So if you're there going all out saying, well, I'm not going to do it, you know, you shouldn't even have to say that about yourself anyway. So, I don't know. It's a messy one. Weird. There was also a man the other week in London who went on a rampage with a sword and killed one 14-year-old boy.
Oh my gosh.
It's not good.
Yes. So if you're having trouble really understanding the struggle of women to, you know, be weary of just men that they're around in spaces, watch the movie Barbarian. There's a very good illustration of women trying to navigate men. And they do something really smart with the casting as well to play into the idea of you can't just look at a man and know whether they're good or bad.
Yeah.
So, yes, watch
creepy
Barbarian.
Bill Skarsgård, you think he's creepy.
Yes,
you think
nice,
he's so
plucky
creepy.
Fun.
They don't trust him.
Nice, plucky fun Justin Long. You think he's a sweet, you know, good guy.
Yeah, it's a total flip.
Yes. So, if you're having trouble with this argument, watch Barbarian. But yes, it was a very interesting debate that has been going around and hurting fragile men all over the internet.
But it's not got anything to do with one-time directors, though, has it, Janine? Unfortunately not. I wonder if any one-time directors have pontificated over this or perhaps are terrible men themselves. Probably many one-time directors are probably terrible men themselves, if we're being honest.
Hollywood, yeah.
That may have been a reason they only made one movie.
Perhaps.
There's many different reasons people will only make one movie, but we're going to get into our Let's Talk for today.
Yes.
And we have a couple of movies we want to bring up from one-time directors to illustrate our answer to the question, who are the best one-time directors of all time?
So this thought for me came out of the recent news, you know, came out a few months ago about Scream 7. They are making a new one. It's going to be directed by the writer of Screams 1, 2, and 4, Kevin Williamson, starring Neve Campbell. And of course, this bringing up of a seventh film brought some, you know, came with its own criticism just based off of the firing of Melissa Barrera. But it also garnered some criticism, not only because Kevin Williamson isn't writing it, it's being written by the writers of 5 and 6, I believe. So people were like, why doesn't he just write it? I mean, he wrote brilliant Scream movies and he's just directing it. And also there was the criticism of him being a one-time director. So how can he direct this film if he's only directed one movie? Teaching Mrs. Tingle, a film we did cover on Morgan Hasn't Seen in our Teachers movies series. And he also wrote that film as well. So very much, you know, a fun teen thriller. I think solid performances, doing something a little bit different, you know, having a different kind of premise than your typical teen movie. Really fun kind of dark comedy elements, you know, Helen Mirren really killing it. This is the first time I ever had even heard of a Helen Mirren. So, you know, I thought it was a well-directed, fun teen movie, but his only directing credit. So that got me thinking about other one-time directors and, you know, making really good films and solid films that they really put a lot into. So who's to say that they're not going to be good when they kind of finally go into their second round, or if they were to ever have taken that opportunity to direct something else. I don't think being a one-time director should be this kind of badge to say, you know, there's so many reasons why maybe they didn't make another film. So,
yeah.
Or they just didn't get the opportunity yet, which now Kevin is. So it just had me thinking about one-time directors.
Yeah. I mean, the two people I want to bring up are both dead, but so you won't get any more.
Yeah.
From these two, you will not get a second directed movie. But this is obviously for two quite different reasons as well. I think the people you want to bring up could still give us a second movie, should they so choose. Are the people you want to bring up of that case?
Well, one of my picks turns out is not a one-time director, so I'm a little sad about that. I was going to bring up David Nutter, probably best known for directing the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones, and I thought his only film he directed was Disturbing Behavior. He has this really great director's cut of that film, which studios cut to pieces, and it did great with test audiences, but the studio interfered and the cut that we got was not as great and didn't do as well. But it was such a strong premise at that movie. I just wanted to talk about the potential of that film, but he directed some movie with Don Johnson in 85, so... Sorry.
Well, that was a Morgan Hasn't Seen movie as well.
Yes, we did a teen thriller series. So I do get my chance to highlight this film and David Nutter and the lost opportunity that he had with this film. One of my picks is Joseph Gordon-Levitt. We actually are going to be talking about his one directed film later this year on one of our Morgan Hasn't Seen series. And that is Don John. I think he started his own kind of production company where he highlights, you know, young up and coming filmmakers. And so he made his own film, Don John, this kind of sex comedy about a guy he stars in the film who has this porn addiction. He really does a great job. I think, you know, he has been in films and TV since he was a little kid. So
A while though. Where's he been? Where's he gone? Has he disappeared?
I'm surprised he didn't direct more things after this. I think he had a really unique voice with just even the story of this film. Kind of this romanticized idea of sex, and then this guy who is, you know, a good looking guy, but he just has this kind of addiction to this thing that people don't really think about. And, you know, when he does end up getting in a relationship with somebody, they don't understand it and they judge him. It has these really kind of fun satirical cameos in it, like they go to see a rom-com because the girl he's with is very much this girly girl, loves these kind of romanticized movies, and like the people starring in the fake rom-com are actually real actors that we know.
So
he does some really fun things with cameos and just ideas of this film, so I'm really surprised he hasn't done more, because Don John, it was a really interesting, unique, well-made film. So I'm excited for you to see it when we cover it in our Provocative Pictures series coming up on Morgan Hesse's theme. But yeah, a great one-time director, young guy who I'm surprised he hasn't done more. He could still do more. So
yeah, there's every chance.
Yes.
There's every chance he could still do more. Unfortunately, there is not every chance that Mr. Bruce Lee could have made more movies. Although, whether you want to really call him a one-time director, so the movie's Way of the Dragon, it's most known as the movie where he fights Chuck Norris in that arena.
Yeah.
And it's a very good fight, obviously. It's a really good martial arts movie. Bruce Lee's obviously very competent at making martial arts movies. He acted as sort of producer on a few of his anyway. Obviously, there's not that many because he died tragically just in 1973 before his most famous movie, Enter the Dragon, was ever released. He did get to see the completed version before he died.
Yeah.
But he did die tragically in 1973. But Way of the Dragon, I think, was the year before. I think it was 72. And yeah, was unfortunately the only one he did ever get to direct. I do think it's a really good movie. It's typical of the genre, of the style of the Bruce Lee movies from around that time, but it's complete. You don't notice an immaturity in the way it's made compared to the other movies. So there's a real clear knowledge there, real clear intelligence there. And obviously Bruce Lee was a ridiculously driven person, ridiculously passionate person, a determined, ambitious character, and just a very kind of appreciated person, very, very liked person.
Yes.
I can only imagine
if he probably would have gone on to make more films had he
passed
away.
And had him star as the lead in them, sure. And it would you would have just got a bigger or a wider array of Bruce Lee martial arts movies, more of which were directed by him. And you get Game of Death, which ends up being released in 78. That's the one where he fights Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah.
Which I always think looks absolutely ridiculous, because Bruce Lee was about 5'5".
Yeah.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's obviously like 7'2" or something like that.
Yeah.
Or 6'11". 7 foot, basically, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is. I always think it looks strange. But that was released long after Bruce Lee died, like 5 years after he died. And it was never fully completed while he was still alive, and I think he was only one of two directors on that one. So Way of the Dragon's really Bruce Lee's only directed movie, and it's a real shame, because I think so many more great martial arts movies could have come had he not, you know, suffered the fate he suffered.
Yes, and we know that, like, people from different perspectives of filmmaking have a really great insight on films that they make. Like, we're seeing it with David Leitch, the stuntman who's been making great films, John Wick series, and now with Fall Guy and Atomic Blonde. So they know how to create these really fun, dynamic action set pieces in their action movies. So imagine Bruce Lee directing things today with his insight on martial arts and action and, you know, he could have really delved into, and then, you know, filmmaking kind of growing with him and him using new techniques to really portray action in a really cool way that he understands, unlike other people. So
imagine what he could have done with outrageous 90s action movies. Say he moved and started making American movies, like proper, which he did really with Enter the Dragon. It was foraying that way. So you could imagine him making American action, Hollywood action movies in the 90s, and then just be
so dynamic,
insane martial arts. You know, wise. It'd have been really good.
Yes.
But what else do we have?
Well, my other director is also someone who cannot make another film. This was a newer movie I kind of discovered in thinking about one-time directors. I actually kind of looked at some lists of people who had only directed one film, and I was really intrigued by this film called Wanda, directed by someone named Barbara Loden, who starred in the film, a really small budget film from 1970. She died in 1980. But she was really intrigued with the idea of this, I think, this news article that she read about a woman who was accomplice in a series of like robberies. And she thanked the judge who sentenced her to 20 years because she was like, you know, I've been someone in my life who has had no direction. So I think being in the prison system for 20 years will give me direction that I haven't had my whole life. Wow, okay. So thank you. So she really fixated on that. And she also kind of read things about prostitutes. And one prostitute kind of had talked about she liked having this kind of like pimp mother figure telling her what to do, because it was the first time anyone had told her what to do. So she kind of based it on how she was feeling in her younger life. So Wanda is this woman who is a mother. Her husband wants a divorce. She's late for court. She goes there and she says, yeah, give him whatever he wants in the divorce. The kids will be better with him. Like, I don't want to do this. Like, and so then she just kind of wanders off, doesn't know what she's doing with her life, just kind of hooking up with random men so she can have somewhere to sleep and get money to eat. And then she kind of wanders into this bar where this man has just like knocked out the bartender and is stealing money from the till. And then she just kind of goes on this crime spree run with this robber who's kind of on the run. And, you know, they kind of strike up this bit of a bond, but he's kind of, you know, bossing her around, and she feels kind of like maybe she has a partner for once in her life. So it's this really just kind of simple on the run type story of this woman who really just has no direction.
It feels like, you know, Barbara Loden, was it the woman's name who directed it, who seems to be fascinated with the maybe slight underbelly of life.
Yes.
And this movie seems to be fixating on that side of things and someone's exploration into that side of things just to get a bit of interest in their own life because they were bored with their past life. That sounds like a very, very interesting movie.
Yeah. She did it with a 4-camera crew, and there's some really interesting like long shots. Like she's going to ask like one of her relatives for money, and they work in like this coal mine. So she's walking through this big kind of cavernous space of just these mounds of coal, and she's wearing all white, and it's this far off distant shot of her just walking in white through these like dark black coal mines to get to this person to ask them for money.
Nice.
Some really interesting shots of driving. So you can tell like somebody's in another car filming her driving and things like that. So it's just like some really interesting ways of shooting things, particularly having just a very small kind of crew and making this really tiny movie that she just kind of really came out of her fixating on this idea of a woman who was looking for some direction in her life. So I found it really interesting.
I like it. I'm definitely going to have to go and find that one somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm sure I will be able to on something or other.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. Where did you find that one for American or North American?
It was on Max. So, I mean, if you do have a Max equivalent, I know it's Max is weird for you guys over there.
It'll be somewhere.
So 1970 Wanda.
Wonder, 1970. Mm-hmm. Well, let's finish up a discussion. No, a discussion on one time, on the best one-time directors. let's put it back on the screen for this.
Yes,
who are the
yes.
best one-time directors?
Because I didn't want to fight you on this, but I totally would have picked this one as well. Like, we fell in love with this right off the bat.
Well, not only is it the best movie by a one-time director.
Yes, yes.
Charles Laughton is the best one-time director ever.
Yes, 100%. And
The Night of the Hunter is one of the best movies ever. So it has to be the pinnacle of best one-time directors.
Yes.
There is no movie quite like Night of the Hunter. It is so stunningly unique. It's amalgamation of dark fairy tale, religious allegory, noir, horror movie, all these kind of melding together genres while stylistically being part silent movie, part noir, like I said.
Yes.
And part fairy tale, it having the poetic visual ability that it has, and being an utter failure critically and financially on release, which devastated Charles Laughton. Charles Laughton, one of our favorite actors, I think it has to be said.
Jimmy. Yes, 100%. We love Charles Laughton. Yeah, we did a whole Charles Laughton series kind of impromptu, unplanned, because we were enjoying him so much in the first movie we watched of his.
Yeah, I mean, please go and listen to our full It's a Wonderful run podcast episode on Night of the Hunter. Yeah. But yes, our entire run of Charles Laughton movies, which I think ended with Night of the Hunter as the one he directed. But it is absolutely devastating when you read into the making of the movie and the reception of the movie that it did so poorly and just heartbroke. You know, broke Laughton's heart because he put so much care into it. There's also never been better child performances in any movie.
Yes, I was going to say that. Mm-hmm.
Than there is in Night of the Hunter. It is a stunning movie. It's one I frequently go back to, as dark and nasty as it is, because it's got such a wholesome, family, hopeful ending to it. As well, where things just really work out, good, pure good triumphs over pure evil at the end of Night of the Hunter, even though that pure good and pure evil are fighting with this by using the same techniques. They're using the same kind of family man, almost religious kind of you know, all American, I'm going to help the town kind of way. They're doing it in such these stunningly different ways. I mean, Shelley Winters is great in the movie, but she's devastating in the movie. Lillian Gish, who plays our mother figure in the second part, in the second half of the movie, or like the last two or the last third of the movie. It's weird in structure. It's great.
Yeah.
I can't say enough about how much I love Night of the Hunter. I could go on and on and on and on about how much I love Night of the Hunter. And we don't have time.
No, we don't.
On and on and on and on about how much I love
an incredible film. Like, it was going to be on, he was going to be on this list 100%. So I was like, you can have Charles Laughton. You know, I want him, but you can have him to talk about him in this great movie. Yes, please go listen to our episode if you want to see us gush even more about Night of the Hunter. Just visually, some great shots, great child performances. You know, Robert Mitchum.
I didn't even mention Robert Mitchum.
Yes, nobody. Really great the kind of horror drama. You know, the facade of this man really just kind of preying on these people. Just really brilliant movie. So
the
brilliant.
Purest
so
depiction of evil.
Yes. I'm so sad that it did not do well for Charles Laughton. But, you know,
and people, you know what?
People love it and it's acclaimed today. And,
and you know what? The book's great as well. The book is great. But what Laughton does visually with the movie of that book is just something else entirely. I would happily read the book again, but I could happily watch the movie every single week.
Yes.
I could.
Okay.
I really, really could. It's so, so good.
Yes. Incredible movie.
Let's end today's show, Janine, as we always liked to do and will continue to like to do, because we did last week in episode 1 of season 2 of Monday Madness. So we're continuing. Fun and games are back. Of course they are. What do we have today? I have an interesting quizzy sort of thing today.
Okay.
I said quizzy 3 times then. Who wants to go first? I'll ask this question again.
I like to get my shame out of the way first, so you can ask
I know you
me. We'll end on you. I like to end the show on your failures.
I think this just should be the way of things now, shouldn't it? I shouldn't even bother asking, because you're going to go first, because you like to let everybody listening and everybody watching, of course, subscribe wherever you are listening.
Yes.
And subscribe, ding your notification bell on the It's Wonderful Podcast YouTube channel if you are watching the full video version of today's Monday Madness. But you like to make everybody remember my disgusting failure more than your disgusting failure.
Yes, because I will inevitably fail this game.
You know what? I hope you do now. I hope you do. My game today, because we've been talking about one-time directors, I thought I'd flip that entirely around and talk about prolific directors' first movies.
Okay.
These people have made many, many movies in their illustrious careers, but what was their first movie? Janine, can you give me the title? And bonus point for year as well. Ooh. I'll give you a bonus point for year of the first movie of Martin Scorsese. What was Martin Scorsese's first movie?
We're talking
full feature movies, so before anybody wants to get nitpicky about it, I'm talking full theatrical feature movies.
It's not going to be one of the big ones, is it?
No. It stars Harvey Keitel. It does star Harvey Keitel. I don't know how long we're gonna get.
I know. Is it a war movie?
It is not a war movie.
Okay. No, I don't know.
Who's that knocking at my door?
Okay, yeah.
1967.
I never would have guessed that.
No, okay.
I'm gonna stunningly fail this game.
Not necessarily, because second up, I want you to give me the title of the movie, or the first movie, of Spike Lee.
First Spike Lee movie.
That was a nice cough right into
sorry,
my ear. Thank you very much for
I'm
that.
Sorry. Was his first
apologize movie... to everyone, not just to me.
Apologies, everyone. Nervous energy. Was it She's Gotta Have It?
It is She's Gotta Have It. Yes, it is She's Gotta Have It. And when was She's Gotta Have It? Bonus points.
87.
Oh, we don't get the bonus points. 86. Thank you very much. Number 3. What was Steven Spielberg's first movie?
I knew that was coming, and I feel like I know it, and I don't remember.
It's one that you never do remember.
Yes, I know.
His first movie.
Yeah. Is it like a one-word title or something?
It's a one-word title, it is, yeah.
Yes.
It's a one-word title. It's got nothing to do with the shark.
No.
or Robert Shaw.
No,
some sort of
I know.
Island beach community.
I don't remember.
It's called Duel.
Yeah.
From 1971. It's about a murderous
man
with a big tractor.
Oh my god. Okay.
Big tractor truck that goes on a murderous rampage, basically.
What? Okay.
Yeah, it's weird. Well, do you perhaps know the first movie of Ridley Scott?
No.
Or perhaps when it was from. Duel, by the way, was 1971. Spielberg's.
What? Ridley Scott.
To give you the year.
Yes.
Looking at 1977.
Ooh.
2 years before Alien. It's not Alien.
No. Wow. That was just like... Okay.
Alien, I think, was his second movie. Maybe his third.
Wow, that's impressive. I'm thinking of things, but I'm like, oh, I might be mixing it up with his brother. So,
yeah. Who's Tell better, me. Ridley or Tony? Who do you prefer? Tony Scott's got his fans, for sure.
Yes, I mean, he was epic in a very certain era.
Rather interestingly, Ridley Scott's first movie also stars Harvey Keitel.
What? Okay, well, no. Yeah, I don't know.
It's The Duelists.
What? So I got what is with all these duels?
And then The Duelists. That's why I put it in there.
Of course you did.
That's why I put it in there.
Oh, my God.
Duelists, yes. Keith Carradine, Harvey Keitel, and Albert Finney.
Okay. 1977. All right.
And lastly, now I seem to remember you were... doing this when you were a Schmodown personality, so when you were hyped up on your movie trivia, what was the first movie of Frank Capra?
Oh my God, why are you doing this to me?
We're talking first feature movies.
First, but then I'm like, am I thinking of his first movie or his first movie that he got nominated for an Oscar for, which was Lady for a Day? So no.
No, it's not Lady Foot.
No, it is older than that.
It is older than that.
Silent movie.
It is a silent movie.
Something about a guy, a man, something.
It is something about a man.
Yes.
It is something about a man, yes.
No, I don't remember.
It's called The Strong Man.
Yes.
1926.
Okay, well, at least I remembered glimmers of things, right?
You did. I like it. Okay. We're going longer than we want to on the new season of Morgan. Morgan hasn't seen, I was going to say then. That's not right. Monday Madness.
Yes.
Morgan and the Machine. But we're fine because
madness.
It is. What's your game today, Janine?
So we're talking one-time directors, I'm talking one-hit wonder directors. So, you know, a hit is subjective. So, you know, you might have liked another.
So these movies are basically awful.
I'm just saying, like, you might consider other films they did also hits, but these films are specifically said to be their one big hit.
Yeah, okay. Okay. I get the
point. So I'm going to have you guess. Try to guess the director and the film.
Oh.
So you can try to guess one or the other. I will. So.
Okay.
Okay. So for this first one, this director's name is iconic within the world of horror, despite only having one hit horror film, a film that gave us the well-known term, The Final Girl.
Bob Clark with Black Christmas?
No.
No, because he had more than one horror movie. There was Dead Men Tell No Tales. I was going to say then that
there was a book written about that created a professor created the term "Final Girl" after she had seen this film.
No, it won't be Texas Chainsaw with Toby Hooper then.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Fundamentally disagree.
He was on this list of one-hit wonders. So
Toby Hooper is a two-hit wonder, not a one-hit wonder.
But I think, isn't there like a dispute on who really directed that film based off of like, yeah.
I don't think there's a dispute. I just, people think it's a Spielberg movie, don't they?
No, well, I think I saw like a production tales kind of thing where it was like,
oh, there might
was,
be.
There was messy. There was messy. Maybe it is messy. Things with that film. But yes, while this director has a star-studded superhero flop on his resume, he's also responsible for this beloved high concept psychological romance from 2004.
High concept psych. Oh, this will be Gondry, won't it? Michel Gondry with Eternal Sunshine.
Yes.
The Spotless Mind. Yes. What on earth terrible superhero movie did Michel Gondry direct?
Well, I wouldn't call it a superhero. I can't remember. I guess not a superhero movie, but
comic book movie.
Yes, comic book movie. The Green Hornet.
Okay.
Yes. I mean that film had Christoph Waltz and Cameron Diaz and this female director is responsible for the dark satirical horror comedy that has not only made a pop culture imprint, but has also been misinterpreted by dude bros for over two decades.
What? Misinterpreted? So this movie has been misinterpreted.
Yes.
And we're looking at a female director.
Yes.
Of a horror movie.
Yes. Somewhat satirical, slightly comedic,
but pretty satirical.
Like the figure in this movie is seen as an icon by dude bros, but you're really kind of missing the point if you glorify this person.
Right, okay. I feel like I should know this. And this is like over two decades. So it's like late 90s, early 2000s ish.
Yes.
Era of a horror movie a totally misinterpreted lead.
And it also has a very kind of pulp culture significance.
I should know this.
Set in the 80s.
Why don't I know this? I'll kick myself. You'll have to tell me. I'll kick myself.
The director is Mary Harron and the film is American Psycho.
Of course, yes. Of course. Yes, yeah. Yes. Thank you very much. Actually, I was thinking horror slasher teeny stuff. I wasn't thinking so serious as American Psycho. But it very much is, much is a horror movie. Don't idolize
Bait. Right? Was I right with that? Just that this actor who played president in a popular film from your neck of the woods, Morgan, made his directorial debut with a film he both starred in and wrote. He was implored to write a film for himself, as he was told once by Billy Wilder to do so, because someone with less than star quality looks like him could never be an actor.
So Billy Wilder ripped into him. I like that.
Yes. He's probably not seen as incredibly attractive. He doesn't play an attractive character in this film that he wrote and starred in. And he played the president in a film that is kind of a UK-based popular film.
But he played the president
in the United States. Yes.
But he's British.
No.
Or is he not? He's not British.
But he appeared in a very popular British film as the American president.
I can't even think of a very popular movie, very popular British movie with the president. I'm just thinking of who Billy Wilder might have called ugly.
Big Christmas. I think of a very popular British Christmas movie.
Who played the president? Why don't I know that? That's very annoying. Who would Billy Wilder have called ugly? I'm guessing that was at some point in the 70s.
This movie it's from 93, I think.
I don't know this.
The film is Sling Blade and the actor is Billy Bob Thornton.
Billy Bob Thornton. Yes. Oh dear, is Billy Bob Thornton's not that ugly?
Well, but Billy Wilder.
Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder thought he was ugly. Fair enough. You can't argue with Billy Wilder.
Yes, which implored him to write that movie. It got lots of critical acclaim.
Oh, very nice. So,
yes.
Okay.
Stars a young Lucas Black, star of Tokyo Drift.
Yeah.
This director, responsible for the plagued infamous production Heaven's Gate, is best known for this acclaimed war film.
Heaven's Gate. No, that's not the... Is that the movie I'm thinking of? Heaven's Gate, the medieval? No. The historical movie, Heaven's Gate. That's not the movie I'm
thinking really of. That really terrible film where there was animal cruelty. Well, I'm not thinking of Days of Heaven. It was super long and it was this huge failure. Like, actors would go make another movie in the middle of still...
I am thinking of Heaven's Gate. Yes. Sorry, I was focusing on just what Heaven's Gate was then. Please repeat what you said.
This director, responsible for the plagued infamous production Heaven's Gate, is best known for this acclaimed war film. So who directed?
Best known for war movie.
Yes.
Heaven's Gate. Wasn't Oliver Stone. No, he's done more than just a war movie, hasn't he? Wasn't
very famous scene.
I hate this. This is the worst. Why? Oh, this is awful. When's the war movie from? 70s. Okay, so yes. Okay. What the war movies from the 70s?
78.
War movies from the 70s. War movies from 78. War movies from 1978. I don't know any war movies from 1978. Apocalypse Now was 79. I can't think of any other late 70s war movie.
Okay.
Is it a World War II movie? Yes, please. My mind's going to go into all these tangential.
The director is Michael Cimino, and the film is The Deer Hunter.
Cimino.
Yeah.
Michael Chusey, I wouldn't have gone Michael Cimino, Heaven's Gate. Sorry about it. And you are very right. I didn't remember The Deer Hunter. Don't know why I didn't remember The Deer Hunter. Good movie. Miserable movie.
Yes.
Miserable. Yes. Very miserable.
Russian movie. Roulette situation. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So those were considered one hit wonder directors.
I suppose he kind of is, isn't he? I suppose he kind of is.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. Fun. Exciting. We've learned things today.
We did.
Fun and games, which is always the best way to do fun and games. We will be back next week with another episode of Monday Madness with Morgan and the Machine. As we've said, subscribe, ding the notification bell on the It's a Wonderful Podcast YouTube channel if you are watching over here. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts as well. On all major podcast platforms for this show, Morgan Hasn't Seen on Wednesdays. It's a Wonderful Podcast, the main show, every Friday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We have you covered over there every single week. If you want to support us on Patreon or donate in any way, there are links in the description of this episode to go and do that. And if you want to find us on social media, on the app formerly known as Twitter, you can find us there at It's a Wonderful One. Find me at the Purple Dawn with a 3 instead of the E in the because, Janine.
3 is the magic number.
On Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at the Purple Dawn. All your madness is where.
You can find me at Janine_Nabeen_ on Twitter, Janine_Nabeen on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. If you want to get any merch for any of our shows, just check the description for the link or search It's Wonderful Podcast on teespring.com. And if you want to purchase any of my art in print form, you can find that at my Big Cartel shop, g9design.bigcartel.com.
There we go. That is doing it for episode 2 of season 2 of Monday Madness. It's exciting. It's all the 3. Well, it's not all the 3s next week, but it's episode 3 of season 2. So it's doubly more exciting.
Yes.
Because, you know, we like the 3.
We're moving on into it. Yeah.
Podcast. Janine, go ahead. Take it away. It is the only thing left to do.
3, 2, 1.
Bye.
Bye.